Essay 1 from Squirrels and Other Fur Bearers. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Squirrels and Other Fur Bearers by John Burroughs. Essay 1. Squirrels. Walking through the early October woods one day, I came upon a place where the ground was thickly strewn with very large, unopened chestnut burrs. On examination, I found that every burr had been cut square off with about an inch of the stem adhering, and not one had been left on the tree. It was not accident, then, but design. Whose design? A squirrel's. The fruit was the finest I had ever seen in the woods, and some wise squirrel had marked it for his own. The burrs were ripe and had just begun to divide. The squirrel that had taken all these pains had evidently reasoned with himself thus: "Now these are extremely fine chestnuts, and I want them. If I wait till the burrs open on the tree, the crows and jays will be sure to carry off a great many of the nuts before they fall. Then, after the wind has rattled out what remain, there are the mice, the chipmunks, the red squirrels, the raccoons, the grouse, to say nothing of the boys and the pigs, to come in for their share. So I will forestall events a little. I will cut off the burrs when they have matured, and a few days of this dry October weather will cause every one of them to open on the ground. I shall be on hand in the nick of time to gather up my nuts." The squirrel, of course, had to take the chances of a prowler, like myself, coming along, but he had fairly stolen a march on his neighbors. As I proceeded to collect and open the burrs, I was half prepared to hear an audible protest from the trees about, for I constantly fancied myself watched by shy but jealous eyes. It is an interesting inquiry how the squirrel knew the burrs would open if left to lie on the ground a few days. Perhaps he did not know, but thought the experiment worth trying. One reason, doubtless, why squirrels are so bold and reckless in leaping through the trees is that, if they miss their hold and fall, they sustain no injury. Every species of tree squirrel seems to be capable of a sort of rudimentary flying, at least of making itself into a parachute, so as to ease or break a fall or a leap from a great height. The so-called flying squirrel does this the most perfectly. It opens its furry vestments, leaps into the air, and sails down the steep incline from the top of the one tree to the foot of the next as lightly as a bird. But other squirrels know the same trick, only their coat skirts are not so broad. One day my dog treed a red squirrel in a tall hickory that stood in a meadow on the side of a steep hill. To see what the squirrel would do when closely pressed, I climbed the tree. As I drew near, he took refuge in the topmost branch, and then, as I came on, he boldly leaped into the air, spread himself out upon it, and, with a quick, tremulous motion of his tail and legs, descended quite slowly and landed upon the ground 30 feet below me, apparently none the worse for the leap, for he ran with great speed, and, eluding the dog, took refuge in another tree. A recent American traveler in Mexico gives a still more striking instance of this power of squirrels, partially to neutralize the force of gravity when leaping or falling through the air. Some boys had caught a Mexican black squirrel, nearly as large as a cat. It had escaped from them once, and when pursued had taken a leap of 60 feet from the top of a pine tree down upon the roof of a house, without injury. This feat had led the grandmother of one of the boys to declare that the squirrel was bewitched, and the boys proposed to put the matter to further test by throwing the squirrel down a precipice 600 feet high. Our traveler interfered to see that the squirrel had fair play. The prisoner was conveyed in a pillow slip to the edge of the cliff, and the slip opened, so that he might have his choice, whether to remain a captive or to take the leap. He looked down the awful abyss, and then back and sidewise, his eyes glistening, his form crouching. Seeing no escape in any other direction, he took a flying leap into space, and fluttered, rather than fell, into the abyss below. His legs began to work like those of a swimming poodle dog, but quicker and quicker, while his tail, slightly elevated, spread out like a feather fan. A rabbit of the same weight would have made the trip in about 12 seconds. The squirrel protracted it in more than half a minute, and landed on a ledge of limestone, where we could see him plainly squat on his hind legs and smooth his ruffled fur, after which he made for the creek with a flourish of his tail, took a good drink, and scampered away into the willow thicket. The story at first blush seems incredible, but I have no doubt our red squirrel would have made the leap safely. Then why not the great black squirrel, since its parachute would be proportionately large? The tails of the squirrels are broad and long and flat, not short and small like those of gophers, chipmunks, woodchucks, and other ground rodents, and when they leap or fall through the air, the tail is arched and rapidly vibrates. A squirrel's tail, therefore, is something more than ornament, something more than a flag. It not only aids him in flying, but it serves as a cloak, which he wraps about him when he sleeps. In making the flying leap I have described, the animal's legs are widely extended, their bodies broadened and flattened, the tail stiffened and slightly curved, and a curious tremulous motion runs through all. It is very obvious that a deliberate attempt is made to present the broadest surface possible to the air, and I think a red squirrel might leap from almost any height to the ground without serious injury. Our flying squirrel is in no proper sense a flyer. On the ground he is more helpless than a chipmunk, because less agile. He can only sail or slide down a steep incline from the top of one tree to the foot of another. The flying squirrel is active only at night, hence its large, soft eyes, its soft fur, and its gentle, shrinking ways. It is the gentlest and most harmless of our rodents. A pair of them, for two or three successive years, had their nest behind the blinds of an upper window of a large, unoccupied country house near me. You could stand in the room inside and observe the happy family through the window-pane against which their nest pressed. There on the window-sill lay a pile of large, shining chestnuts, which they were evidently holding against a time of scarcity, as the pile did not diminish when I observed them. The nest was composed of cotton and wool, which they filched from a bed in one of the chambers, and it was always a mystery how they got into the room to obtain it. There seemed to be no other avenue but the chimney flue. Red and gray squirrels are more or less active all winter, though very shy, and I am inclined to think, partially nocturnal in their habits. Here a gray one has just passed, came down the tree and went up this. There he dug for a beech nut and left the burr on the snow. How did he know where to dig? During an unusually severe winter, I have known him to make long journeys to a barn in a remote field where wheat is stored. How did he know there was wheat there? In attempting to return, the adventurous creature was frequently run down and caught in the deep snow. His home is in the trunk of an old birch or maple, with an entrance far up amid the branches. In the spring he builds himself a summer house of small leafy twigs in the top of a neighboring beech, where the young are reared and much of the time passed, but the safer the retreat in the maple is not abandoned, and both old and young resort thither in the fall, or when danger threatens. Whether this temporary residence amid the branches is for elegance or pleasure, or for sanitary reasons or domestic convenience, the naturalist has forgotten to mention. The elegant creature, so cleanly in its habits, so graceful in its carriage, so nimble and daring in its movements, excites feelings of admiration akin to those awakened by the birds and the fairer forms of nature. His passage through the trees is almost a flight. Indeed, the flying squirrel has little or no advantage over him, and in speed and nimbleness cannot compare with him at all. If he miss his footing and fall, he is sure to catch on the next branch. If the connection be broken, he leaps recklessly for the nearest spray or limb, and secures his hold, even if it be by the aid of his teeth. His career of frolic and festivity begins in the fall, after the birds have left us and the holiday spirit of nature has commenced to subside. How much his presence adds to the pleasure of a saunter in the still October woods! You step lightly across the threshold of the forest, and sit down upon the first log or rock to await the signals. It is so still that the ear suddenly seems to have acquired new powers, and there is no movement to confuse the eye. Presently you hear the rustling of a branch, and see it sway, or spring, as the squirrel leaps from or to it. Or else you hear a disturbance in the dry leaves, and mark one running upon the ground. He has probably seen the intruder, and not liking his stealthy movements, desires to avoid a nearer acquaintance. Now he mounts a stump to see if the way is clear, then pauses a moment at the foot of a tree to take his bearings, his tail as he skims along undulating behind him, and adding to the easy grace and dignity of his movements. Or else you are first advised of his proximity by the dropping of a false nut, or the fragments of the shucks rattling upon the leaves. Or again, after contemplating you a while unobserved, and making up his mind that you are not dangerous, he strikes an attitude on a branch, and commences to quack and bark, with an accompanying movement of his tail. Late in the afternoon, when the same stillness reigns, the same scenes are repeated. There is a black variety, quite rare, but mating freely with the gray, from which it seems to be distinguished only in color. The red squirrel is more common and less dignified than the gray, and oftener guilty of petty larceny about the barns and grain fields. He is most abundant in mixed oak, chestnut, and hemlock woods, from which he makes excursions to the fields and orchards, spinning along the tops of the fences, which afford not only convenient lines of communication, but a safe retreat if danger threatens. He loves to linger about the orchard, and sitting upright on the topmost stone in the wall, or on the tallest stake in the fence, chipping up an apple for the seeds, his tail conforming to the curve of his back, his paws shifting and turning the apple, he is a pretty sight, and his bright purr appearance atones for all the mischief he does. At home in the woods he is very frolicsome and loquacious. The appearance of anything unusual, if, after contemplating it a moment, he concludes it not dangerous, excites his unbounded mirth and ridicule, and he snickers and chatters, hardly able to contain himself, now darting up the trunk of a tree and squealing in derision, then hopping into position on a limb, and dancing to the music of his own cackle, and all for your special benefit. There is something very human in this apparent mirth and mockery of the squirrels. It seems to be a sort of ironical laughter, and implies self-conscious pride and exultation in the laughter. "What a ridiculous thing you are, to be sure," he seems to say. "How clumsy and awkward, and what a poor show for a tail! Look at me! Look at me!" And he capers about in his best style. Again he would seem to tease you and provoke your attention, then suddenly assumes a tone of good-natured, childlike defiance and derision. That pretty little imp, the chipmunk, will sit on the stone above his den and defy you as plainly as if he said so, to catch him before he can to get into his hole. A hard winter affects the chipmunks very little. They are snug and warm in their burrows in the ground and under the rocks, with a bountiful store of nuts or grain. I have heard of nearly a half bushel of chestnuts being taken from a single den. They usually hole up in November and do not come out again till March or April, unless the winter is very open and mild. Gray squirrels, when they have been partly domesticated in parks and groves near dwellings, are said to hide their nuts here and there upon the ground, and in winter to dig them up from beneath the snow, always hitting the spot accurately. The red squirrel lays up no stores like the provident chipmunk, but scours about for food in all weathers, feeding upon the seeds in the cones of the hemlock that still cling to the tree, upon sumac bobs, and the seeds of frozen apples. I have seen the ground under a wild apple tree that stood near the woods completely covered with the chonkings of the frozen apples, the work of the squirrels in getting at the seeds. Not an apple had been left, and apparently not a seed had been lost. But the squirrels in this particular locality evidently got pretty hard up before spring, for they developed a new source of food supply. A young bushy-topped sugar maple, about 40 feet high, standing beside a stone fence near the woods, was attacked and more than half denuded of its bark. The object of the squirrels seemed to be to get at the soft, white, mucilaginous substance, cambium layer, between the bark and the wood. The ground was covered with fragments of the bark, and the white naked stems and branches have been scraped by fine teeth. When the sap starts in the early spring, the squirrels add this to their scanty supplies. They perforate the bark of the branches of the maples with their chisel-like teeth, and suck the sweet liquid as it slowly oozes out. It is not much as food, but evidently it helps. I have said the red squirrel does not lay by a store of food for winter use, like the chipmunk and the wood mice. Yet in the fall he sometimes hoards in a tentative, temporary kind of way. I have seen his savings, butternuts and black walnuts, stuck here and there in saplings and trees near his nest, sometimes carefully inserted in the upright fork of a limb or twig. One day, late in November, I counted a dozen or more black walnuts put away in this manner in a little grove of locusts, chestnuts, and maples by the roadside, and could but smile at the wise forethought of the rascally squirrel. His supplies were probably safer that way than if more elaborately hidden. They were well distributed, his eggs were not all in one basket, and he could go away from home without any fear that his storehouse would be broken into in his absence. The next week, when I passed that way, the nuts were all gone but two. I saw the squirrel that doubtless laid claim to them on each occasion. There is one thing the red squirrel knows unerringly that I do not. There are probably several other things. That is, on which side of the bud or nut the meat lies. He always gnaws through the shell so as to strike the kernel broadside, and thus easily extract it, while to my eyes there is no external mark or indication, in the form or appearance of the nut, as there is in the hickory nut, by which I can tell whether the edge or the side of the meat is toward me. But examine any number of nuts that the squirrels have rifled, and as a rule you will find they always drill through the shell at the one spot where the meat will be most exposed. Occasionally one makes a mistake, but not often. It stands them in hand to know, and they do know. Doubtless, if butternuts were a main source of my food, and I were compelled to gnaw into them, I should learn, too, on which side my bread was buttered. The cheeks of the red and gray squirrels are made without pockets, and whatever they transport is carried in the teeth. They are more or less active all winter, but October and November are their festal months. Invade some butternut or hickory grove on a frosty October morning, and hear the red squirrel beat the juba on a horizontal branch. It is a most lively jig, what the boys call a regular breakdown, interspersed with the squeals and snickers and derisive laughter. The most noticeable peculiarity about the vocal part of it is the fact that it is a kind of a duet. In other words, by some ventriloquial tricks, he appears to accompany himself, as if his voice split up, a part forming a low guttural sound, and a part a shrill nasal sound. End of Essay 1.